I want to talk about hemolytic anemias, and actually that's what we've been, frankly, one of the things we've already talked about in a way. The term hemolysis means destruction of the red blood cells. And that's obviously going on in all of us all the time. We're destroying old red cells. We are taking red cells out of circulation. We're breaking them down. We're recycling the amino acids and the protein and the hemoglobin. We're definitely recycling the iron. You know, all that stuff is getting reused. So hemolysis goes on all the time. We constantly break down red cells. When we see an anemia develop on the basis of that, it's accelerated hemolysis. So we use the term hemolytic anemia to say that on the basis of accelerated breakdown of red cells, we are seeing something, we're actually seeing manifestations of an anemia, and that they have decreased oxygen carrying capacity, the person has decreased stamina, shortness of breath, that sort of business, and they're pale and that sort of thing. So they really have the manifestations of an anemia, because they are anemic, because the bone marrow simply can't keep up with the destruction. Now the destruction can be an acceleration of the normal process, which we've already talked about. For example, in the case of genetic things, sickle cell, certainly spherocytosis. Here's an example where the cells basically prematurely age and are jerked out of circulation, and it definitely leads to an anemia. As sickle cell disease, those red cells not only contort and become maybe permanently deformed and clog up small vessels, which is bad in the kidney and bad all over the place, but additionally, when you have the red cell is all full of spiky protein, crystallized hemoglobin, it pokes holes in it, and the red cell has a shortened lifespan. Even if it is not so crystallized that it results in complete deformity of the red cell, there may be some level of crystallization that occurs in there that keeps the red cell from being flexible. And so even a cell that is not completely sickled may still be inflexible and breaks down and is prematurely removed. So there is internal hemolysis. Now these sorts of things generally occur in the by the normal pathway. In other words, they are recognized as being abnormal, and they are taken out by the spleen, and that's where all of it goes right now. You're recycling red cells right now, and it's going on in your spleen and to a very small extent in your liver. And there are fixed macrophages in there that stay in place, and they're pulling out red cells, and they're breaking them down. That is the normal hemolytic pathway. That is the expected situation in terms of recycling that. What we see here is just an accelerated form of that. And we refer to that as extravascular hemolysis. In other words, it doesn't occur within the circulating blood. It's extravascular. It's outside of the lumen of the small of these blood vessels, but it's the expected way. It's the way you're doing it right now. It's the way you normally recycle red blood cells. It's just that it's on the fast track. And so it is extravascular. It's occurring inside the cells. We don't have free hemoglobin. See, if we had red cells breaking and hemolyzing and being broken and smashed in the circulating blood, we'd have circulating free hemoglobin, which, by the way, is very toxic to kidney cells. But we don't see that in this. This is technically hemolytic anemia. Both of those can be right there, spherocytosis for sure. But it's extravascular hemolysis. It's going on outside of the vascular system. We're going to take a look at a situation where maybe that doesn't happen. So that would be extravascular hemolysis, accelerated loss, but basically by the normal pathway. Now we do have occasionally acquired hemolytic anemias that occur because they're antibody mediated. They can be antibody mediated in two ways. One is that you have antigen antibody complexes that basically get stuck on the surface of the red cell. And then and your immune system sees it and sort of sucks it out and says, whoa, there must be a bacteria or something on the surface of this rascal. Let's get rid of it. So one is you can break them down. You can have something like that going on where the antibody fools the spleen into thinking that the red cell is non-self, and then it pulls it out and destroys it. So that's still extravascular. Or you can have intravascular antibody mediated, in which the antibody is made, it binds to the red cell, it fixes complement drills a hole through the membrane, the red cell expands and pops. So there's intra and extravascular hemolytic anemia. The extravascular is kind of an acceleration of the normal mechanism of removing senescent cells. Intravascular is where red cells are actually popping inside the circulatory system. Their guts are going. They're losing hemoglobin. The hemoglobin is now in the circulatory system. Now, normally this may happen on occasion anyway, but free hemoglobin in the circulating blood is really toxic material. And so we have a system, we have circulating proteins called haptoglobins that are circulating in the bloodstream that only job is to suck up free hemoglobin. We've all got that because to a certain degree, we all break a few red blood cells every now and then. I'm probably breaking some in my feet because I'm standing up and walking around. You're definitely breaking some in your butt because you're sitting there and you're wiggling around, okay? So that's happening. So you do have some rupture of red blood cells on a daily basis, but you don't want that free hemoglobin. That free hemoglobin is going to be very toxic to the kidney epithelial cells. And so you have a system of sucking it up. So when we have massive intravascular hemolysis, that is to say within the lumen of the blood vessels, if it's antibody mediated, antibody's fixed, complement gets stuck on there, holes in the membrane, the cell ruptures. Well, we will very quickly overcome the capacity of the haptoglobin to bind free hemoglobin. And yeah, it'll suck it up, but then that's it. I mean, it can only do so much. And our system is not equipped to handle millions and millions of red cells rupturing. It's equipped to handle a handful of them. And so we have measurable free hemoglobin in the bloodstream. We have measurable hemoglobin coming out in the urine. And of course, it's doing damage to the kidney as it does so. So intravascular is often antibody mediated, but not exclusively so. And what we're looking at here is an example of antibody mediated hemolytic anemia. And one of the things I hope you will see is that there's considerable variation in size of the red cells. Very large one here, which is probably a young cell, very small ones here, fragmented cells. So we can see that in the circuit when we see a peripheral blood smear, we get a good idea that something is going on that's destroying those red cells. It doesn't have to be antibody mediated. It can actually be mechanical. There are a couple ways in which that occurs. One is people who have certain kinds of heart valve replacements. Today we use a lot of porcine valves. In other words, they'll take the pig aorta. While one part of the pig's being processed into sausages, you know, the others are harvesting their aortic valves. And the aortic valves are fixed with glutaraldehyde, and then the valve is sewn into an annulus, and the valve is what gets replaced when someone needs a heart valve replacement. That's what you typically get. There are mechanical valves, however, that are steel, like a ball in a cage, where the ball moves back and forth and goes click, 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 and you can actually hear it. You mean, you stand next to a person, you can tell what they've got in heart valves. But that thing will often beat those red cells to pieces, because it's always bang, 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 bang. The metal, the ball in the cage is going back and forth. They tried coating it with Teflon and all kinds of stuff. We still beat them up. We don't see that with the porcine valves, which is an aortic valve that will open and close and behave in a manner like a normal valve would. So it can be a mechanical thing. It can also occur if we have a problem clotting. If there's a runaway clotting condition in which lots of strings of fibrin are sewn into small blood vessels. And that might occur with an overwhelming infection and a lot of endothelial cell injury all over the body. And you got lots of strings of fibrin. And these things are very rigid. And when the red cells fly past them and over them, it slices the red cell in half. And part of it will close up, but part of it may not. And so when we see these problems with kind of accelerated blood clotting and lots of fibrin strings in small blood vessels, we'll see a lot of fragmented cells. And it's a mechanical problem, effectively. And then we will see an acquired hemolytic, intravascular hemolytic anemia with a lot of free hemoglobin and the potential for basically killing the person's kidneys. So we make this distinction between intravascular and extravascular. Extravascular hemolysis is what's going on right now in all of us as we're removing senescent red cells. It's just that in these situations, it's an acceleration of the normal process. In the intravascular, we don't really ever hemolyze very many, and we're equipped to handle the free hemoglobin when we do, but we just don't have very much of that occurring at any point. All right, so what we've looked at to this point is problems of red cell survival and red cell quantity, whether they're bleeding out or whether you're internally destroying them or something like that. Let's take a look at problems with red cell production. So there can be genetic related issues in which you simply don't, either things aren't growing as they should. Most times what we're looking at, however, will be nutritional problems, such as iron deficiency, B12. You just got to have a certain amount of, you got to have, you know, the precursors to build the hemoglobin and complete the process of inserting the iron and so on. When we see B12 deficiency, for example, it's very difficult to have a B12 deficient patient without some problem, a nutritional deficiency. Almost always in the case of a B12 problem, the problem is one of absorption. Yeah, it is possible that you don't have adequate B12 in your diet, but in the Western world, in southern Indiana, the likelihood of that is practically zero. But we sure see plenty of people with B12 deficiencies, elderly people especially. They're all over the place. So if you don't, if you have plenty of it in the diet, how in the dickens do they become B12 deficient? Well, we'll talk about that. So the problem in this case is one of absorption because it's a complex mechanism by which we absorb it. Folic acid, that sort of thing. Again, a chronic anemia in terms of production. Well, you got to have a healthy bone marrow, of course, but on the other hand, there has to be the stimulus to the red cells to actually do it. So everybody who has kidney failure, long-term kidney failure, is going to develop a life-threatening anemia. And in years past, that was actually what often killed them, was that they, if you can't produce any red cells, you know you only got 120 days left, and we didn't even have that much, because you're not going to go down to the last red cell. So you may have a couple of months, maximally, if suddenly you lost your capacity to produce erythropoietin. So anybody with kidney disease, and there are plenty of them out there, are going to not be able to produce red cells. The bone marrow is perfectly happy. Iron's there, B12 is there, folic acid, everything that's needed to make the red cell and the hemoglobin is there, but there's no hormonal stimulus coming from the kidney because the kidneys are dead. So you got to have that business in order to drive it. And the other thing would be aplasia of the line. In other words, can something really go wrong with the red cell precursors themselves so that they either die off or they just don't give a crap anymore? And actually, there are certain viral infections in which the red cells are the red cell precursor is the principal target. Now, most of us adults have probably already had our little bout with that. It happens to be a dog virus and that does it. But occasionally, we'll see a child who has a pretty severe anemia, transient anemia, and in that situation, we always do a bone marrow to be sure that they have everything they've got, that there's not something wrong with the bone marrow, and we'll find there are no red cell precursors. And so the next thing is be sure they got erythropoietin. Can they make that? So you can do a blood level for erythropoietin. And if they got no precursors, it's almost always due to one of these viral infections that has instantly shuttled down. And most of them, the virus, they defeat the virus, the red cell precursors return before 120 days or 60 days happen. It typically is within a few weeks, and the red cell line returns. And then it kicks it back in high gear for a little while and restores the red cells that were removed before the precursor cells were actually really rolling. And that typically occurs somewhere in age around 2 to 4, somewhere in there where we see that. There are other things, antibody-mediated things in tumors that can also, have nothing to do with the bone marrow, and particularly tumors of the thymus gland that can lead to suppression of the number of red cell precursors. So it doesn't matter how much erythropoietin you got on board and how effective or how many precursors you have of manufacturing there, the red cell precursors are gone. The red cell line is either gone permanently or temporarily. So problems of production then have to do with a variety of things. Most of the time what we're looking at here is either something that's a problem of nutrition or lack of erythropoietin in the form of chronic renal failure. Pretty clearly, it's important to understand which is which because that's what we're going to be treating. So if we take a look at a nutritional deficiency, the real question is, what's the deal? Is it not in the diet? Is it a problem of absorption? Is it a problem of utilization? One of the things that we know in the case of women who are pregnant, you give them a lot of extra folic acid. They're busy producing red cells for two, almost. Well, maybe that's a little bit of a stretch. But women are put on folic acid. Folic acid is a water-soluble vitamin. You have to have a supply every single day. You have no storage of it, unlike B12, where you've got 2 years' supply, probably. So you got to have folic acid every single day. Among other things, it's involved, of course, in development, fetal development, as you probably know, neural tube closure and that sort of thing. So you want to have mom on that. So is it really a problem of utilization? Does she need or he need more? Somebody, there are other reasons to have this. For example, people who are being treated with chemotherapy and recovering from that, and all of a sudden have much greater need for things. Is absorption. So in the case of vitamin B12, for example, if you can't absorb the vitamin B12, it doesn't matter how much is in your diet. And of course, do we not have it in the diet at all? It is possible to be nutritionally deficient in folic acid in elderly people who don't eat a lot of green leafy vegetables, and when we really do see a nutritional deficiency, it's just not there. And so we recommend they be on a daily diet, daily supplement, vitamin supplement, if they're not eating green leafy vegetables or whatever else, you know, that, like that. Okay, so that would be the thing when we think about a problem of production. Now, I mentioned genetics. We're going to start there. We're going to look at other things that are problems of production in the bone marrow. But let's start out with something that's genetic on the basis. And this is thalassemia. There are literally hundreds of versions of thalassemia. Thalassemia, I used to know how that came about. It has to do with somebody who has a funny chest. This is a genetic version in which you simply don't make the proper amount of beta and alpha chains in sequence. In other words, you know hemoglobin, the typical A1 hemoglobin that's circulating in our red cells, most of us, what's it composed of? How many protein chains make up each hemoglobin molecule? 25. There are four, right? I was seeing people do that. All right, so there are four hemoglobin, there are four protein chains or two alpha, two beta chains, right? That makes up the hemoglobin molecule, and each red cell is just gobbled all full of that stuff. Well, you kind of got to have things being made in the proper, since they're coded for in different places, you sort of got to be sure that you're making roughly the same amount of alpha chains as beta chains, so you don't have a lot of stuff left over. I mean, it's inefficient, but if you have that, sometimes those high levels of one chain that's left over, you got no dancing partner, okay, they're going to get into mischief. You know what I'm talking about here? Okay. And so what's going to happen is you get a bunch of them together, and they're going to sort of crystallize. A bunch of beta chains left over that don't have a dancing partner, they're going to crystallize and stick to the cell membrane. That's going to be a problem. So genetics can be one of several things. If you're not making enough beta chain to meet the alpha chain needs, and that's the most common thing. If you can't make alpha chains, then nothing happens. You don't get out of the uterus. Because if you take a look even at fetal hemoglobin and all those early hemoglobins in utero, they all have alpha chains. So if you can't make alpha chains, you're in trouble right from the get-go. Beta chain's a little bit different. You have fetal hemoglobin, you're going to go ahead and develop the fetus, you're going to be born, that sort of thing. So what are some of the problems? Well, let me just, you know, when we make the beta chain, there's a lot of modification. There's modification of the RNA. You know, we're lipsing out part of the RNA, we're fusing it back together. And what this is just showing are some of the many different sites that we've identified when we say we have someone has a beta thalassemia. What it means is they don't produce adequate amounts of beta, the beta chain. And it can be because there's a promoter problem. Now, we got multiple copies of this gene, by the way. So you gotta inherit maybe a couple of these bad guys. Maybe it's a promoter sequence that's missing. Maybe you can't, there's some exons that stay in there that shouldn't be there. Maybe the RNA is very short-lived. You know, we transcribe, translate that a bunch, and then we break it down. Maybe it doesn't get translated enough. Maybe there's something wrong with one of the two, you know, recognition ends. But this is just showing some of the common sites where we know mutations occur that lead to either a stop code that's in there, something like that. So that you never finish making the beta chain. And the result is that you don't have adequate amount of the combined, you don't have the amount of alpha and beta chains together. And so alpha chains build up in excess, and they often will then go ahead and sort of glom together. So you got two things that are going to happen now. One, you can't make enough hemoglobin, so that's a problem. And number two, when you got the alpha chains in high levels and they glom together, if that kind of crystallized element sticks to the membrane of the cell, it causes it to either be rigid or does something to it so that the spleen wants to remove it early. So one of the principal problems in terms of thalassemias is really twofold. One is genetics, in that you don't produce enough of the average of the expected hemoglobin, the two alphas, two betas, because you can't produce enough beta chain. The other thing is the cells that are produced are removed prematurely. So there's a combined hit here in terms of accelerated hemolysis, accelerated destruction of the cells, of the red cells, but also they're inadequate in terms of their quantity of hemoglobin. So thalassemias are quite interesting. Once again, we see them largely in the Mediterranean area. Again, it's associated with the heterozygote stage. It's associated with conferring some kind of relative resistance to malaria. Wherever we have malaria, we have thalassemias, we have sickling hemoglobins, and that sort of business. This is showing some of the changes that we see. If you can imagine, again, the kidneys are working fine, so they're telling the red cell precursors, will you please get in gear, and they're starting to flood the system with erythropoietin. And so we'll see expanded bone marrow space. In fact, we will see such an expanded bone marrow space in the skull, X-ray, it looks like their hair's all standing on end. And you can actually make this diagnosis in postmortem material, skeletal material, archaeologic material. We can easily see who, living in the Mediterranean, how many Roman soldiers it was that had thalassemias, a version of thalassemia, because we can take an X-ray of their skull and we can see that. So it's a mismatch between production of beta chains and so forth. Red cells are kind of small and crazy. They may have congealed alpha proteins within them so that they are prematurely removed. But the bone marrow space does get expanded because it does try to respond. The kidneys say, hey, let's get in gear here. And the bone marrow says, you know, I'm doing the best I can with what I got. This is an archaeologic specimen, by the way. This is not a living person. And it's just showing this very expanded bone marrow space. And hair on end is kind of a good way of looking at that. So this is actually an archaeologic specimen from somebody who lived hundreds and hundreds of years ago, maybe more than that, somewhere in the Middle East or Mediterranean. All right, thalassemias. I think that's a rather interesting thing. Again, it's a two-hit phenomenon in the sense that you not only have the inability to produce, completely produce all the hemoglobin you need, because the buildup of the mismatched proteins, then the red cells have a shorter lifespan as well. All right, let's just take a look here at a nutritional deficiency that I've talked about in the past, and these are these are very common, truthfully, in elderly people, and that's vitamin B12. Now, vitamin B12 is involved in methyl transfer. Folic acid and B12 both are involved in producing thymidine. The difference between DNA and RNA is what? We got uracil in one, we got thymidine in the other. And thymidine has a methyl group attached to it, and thymidine is essentially a modified uracil. And so what we're seeing here is that we have the inability to produce thymidine. So cells that are rapidly growing and dividing, which are all those cells in that early phases of maturation. Remember the very first slide, or almost the first slide we looked at, off on this side of the slide, we had ability to reproduce and reproduce, and it had to be that way in order to make all the cells we needed. So even though they were along the lines of maturing, they also had the capability of dividing and giving rise to more of their own kind at that stage of maturation. Remember that slide? Leaving it very hopefully set and then stop. Remember that slide? Yes, okay. Well, if you retard the capacity to actually divide the cell, if you cannot produce the DNA, if you don't have the thymidine in there, you can't finish making the DNA, therefore the cell can't go ahead and divide. And so what you've got is a lot of stuff that gets built up in this early phase, and they never, they don't complete the division process to give rise to more of their own kind at that stage. So the end result is you simply don't have enough mature red cells coming out the other end. These are macrocytic cells. They're quite large. Both the precursor and the finished product cell are very big. We can imagine that it could be dietary. All right, suppose B12 is not in our diet. That's possible. It's very unlikely, but it's possible. More likely what's happening, it's a problem of absorption. And here we have a complex way of absorbing B12 because we want to beat the bugs to it. And so what happens, as I say, we want to beat our GI flora to it. And so there are cells in the lining of the stomach that produce a binding protein that binds the B12, and then the B12 is fixed so it can't get away, and it goes all the way down to the very last part of the small bowel. And there are special receptors on the cells that bind the carrier protein, the intrinsic factor, and bring in B12 and the intrinsic factor together. Now, if you lose the capacity to produce the intrinsic factor, then it doesn't matter how much B12 is in your diet. You can't absorb it. And that's what we see in some elderly people. They develop antibodies against constituents of this. They develop what's called a chronic gastritis. They kill those cells that make that, and that's the end of it. And so typically their presentation is one of problems of anemia and neurological issues, because the same thing goes on. We're constantly making the myelin covering in the central nervous system, the Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system, and that also requires B12. The other possibility is that you've got something wrong with your GI tract, like Crohn's disease, or you've had surgery and removed that part of the bowel, and simply the part that was supposed to be, that's responsible for absorbing it, isn't there anymore. Well, what do you do? We're going to give people shots of B12, is what it amounts to. It's actually a very easy fix. So when we see an elderly person or a young person with a B12 deficiency, again, we can measure it in the bloodstream. The red cells are very large. They're huge. And so we can kind of say, you know, yeah, you're anemic, number one. Hemoglobin's down, crit's down. Your MCV is off the charts here. Normally the MCV is up to about 100 cubic microns. Your MCV is 130. It's a huge cell. You're either folic acid or B12 deficient, because they're both linked in the same process of that methyl transfer and the problem in terms of the stumbling of the cells dividing as they mature is going on with both of the deficiencies. So they're very large cells, delayed nuclear maturation, that sort of thing. Well, we can reverse all that very quickly by giving them, and then they're going to get injections the rest of their lives. I tell the students, the med students, this is a wonderful thing for a doc because, number one, your patients aren't going to die. Number two, they're not going to get well. They're going to come back to you for a shot every time. They're going to help you make boat payments the rest of your life. You know, you'll have things like that too, friends. I'm going to tell you, you know, glaucoma and that kind of stuff. They're not going to die with it. And they're not going to get over it. You know, they're going to make your boat payments. So at any rate, B12 has a complex system of absorption. And nutritional deficiencies, at least in this part of the world, are just unheard of. So if we see somebody with that, well, that could mean also, you know what, if they're not really, maybe there are other things they're not absorbing well either. And if you put them on an oral supplement, you're not going to change anything because they simply can't absorb it. So B12, again, is involved in the nuclear maturation. What we see will be these enormous precursor cells. You know, they're trying to make more. And the whole business of the nuclear maturation, nuclear division, cytoplasmic maturation is now completely out of sync. And so what we see, the end product will be a very large mature cell, but fewer in numbers. Additionally, because we're also constantly replacing the myelin covering on our axons in the central nervous system and the Schwann covering on the axons of the peripheral nervous system, we'll also see a lot of problems, more often peripheral than central, but we'll see neurological problems as well in a person who has a B12 deficiency, and those may never actually correct. The anemia will definitely can be corrected, but if it gets to the point of a lot of neurological damage to particularly the peripheral nerves or the Schwann cells being damaged, that often does not come back. And then you get to then the doc gets to develop a relationship with his lawyer or her lawyer. Okay, so we could actually, since the B12 and the folic acid are both coenzymes that rotate this thing, we could actually correct a B12 anemia if we didn't know for sure what it is. A doc could put the person on very high levels of folic acid and make the anemia get better. We would circumvent the need for the B12. But the folic acid has nothing to do with the neurological stuff. So a person's anemia gets better, but because they're still B12 deficient, the neurological problem marches right on. So that's why it's important that the doc really understand, is this B12 or is this folic acid? Because in terms of the way the cells are going to look, they're going to look exactly the same. The process is the same, inability to manufacture thymidine. And this is looking at the process going on here that's taking place that involves the folic acid here and the B12 somewhere else, I don't know. But at any rate, so folic acid deficiency will lead to exactly the same problem because it's another one of the coenzymes involved in that methylation of uracil. But you have to have a daily amount of it. It's got to come in every day, and it's very easy to get it. And it's never a problem with absorption. This one we can replace by dietary supplement. So it's important when someone presents with an anemia that the doc figure out that this thing is in fact folic acid or B12. So those were large, those were macrocytes, big red cells, big precursors. And the real distinguishing thing in terms of the anemia was looking at the MCV, the mean corpuscular volume. How big are they? Normally our cells are from roughly the mid-80s up to the late 90s, something like that, you know, maybe 82 to about 100 cubic microns. And so these cells would have been quite large. Now we're looking at cells that are going to be quite small, microcytic anemia. And this is iron deficiency anemia. You are capable here of having an iron deficient state. It's just not in the diet adequately enough, or you're losing faster than you absorb it. Again, either menstrual flow or slow bleeding ulcer, or more frequently, a cancer, either stomach or colon cancer, and you're losing it. We have a heck of a time determining really how much iron is needed, and we have no capacity to get rid of it, by the way, other than bleeding. So if you get overloaded on iron, which is very bad, by the way, you'll kill your liver if you have too much iron, kill your heart. It does it by oxidative injury. So the way in which we monitor that is that iron is absorbed way up here early in the GI tract. It's absorbed in the duodenum. And so depending on how much iron is in the circulating blood, free iron, I'm not talking about bound to hemoglobin or anything, but how much is in the circulating blood, or at least bound to a transport protein, it will cause the epithelial cells in the duodenum to express a protein, manufacture and express a protein, on transmembrane protein on the outside of the cell that binds iron. So if you've got an adequate amount of iron in the bloodstream, then there is no signal to produce that protein, so whatever's in the diet goes away. We actually only absorb about 2 or 3% of the iron that's in our diet. And most of it does come from eating meat. There are plenty of sources, vegetable sources of it, but most of our diet happens to come that way. So if you've got enough iron, you don't express much of this protein, you don't really bind it. If you don't, then it's the flip side of the case. Then you're going to hyperabsorb, you're going to bring in iron from the GI tract. Because we really don't have any way to get rid of it, and it is very, very toxic. All right, so iron deficiency that we see, the cells are small, they don't have any problem making the nucleus, and so division in the early phases, phases of development and maturation of cells, that goes on just fine. The nuclear part does, but the cytoplasm now really lags behind the nuclear maturity. And so when we take a look at cells in the bone marrow, they're tiny, they're little guys, they don't have a lot of hemoglobin because, of course, there's no iron, at least complete hemoglobin. They're able to make the protein, but you can't put the iron in it, so the assemblage isn't quite right. So you end up with very peaked looking cells. They just don't have very much in there. They're small, and we do have to make a distinction between thalassemias, by the way. Remember we talked about just a moment ago, thalassemias, which is genetic, right? And some people who carry one copy of that thalassemic gene will have typically very small cells. An interesting thing occurs. Again, the problem is, right, what was the problem with thalassemia? You can't make the hemoglobin, right? You can't match the number of alpha chains to beta chains, so you can't do that. Here, it's a triple problem. You can't really assemble the alpha and beta chains properly, at least once they get together, you don't have any iron in there. So thalassemia, the heterozygote form of thalassemias will have really tiny cells for exactly the same reason we have here. Their cytoplasm is not mature, but it's not a problem of iron deficiency at all, right? It was genetic. We didn't have the proper balance. So it may fool somebody who takes a look at the peripheral blood and they'll say, you've got really tiny cells out there. But the difference between that and someone who has iron deficiency is that those really tiny cells have a complete amount of hemoglobin in them. And instead of having just a few tiny cells, you have a whole bunch of them. Normally, we will have about 3.5-4 million red blood cells per cubic millimeter of blood. The person who is heterozygote for thalassemia will have 6 million. So if you took a look at how much hemoglobin's out there, you'd say the hemoglobin's perfectly fine. It's just that each red cell is a lot smaller, but we got many more red cells. They do the job fine, and the person who is a carrier for the gene never really knows it, because they're never really anemic. But if we just look at a blood smear, we'd say, you know what, you got little bitty cells. But they're not hypochromatic. They're not really pale and washed out, whereas iron deficiency will be. So I hope I didn't confuse you with that, but you want to sort of keep in mind that size of red cell is important, but also the quantity of the hemoglobin and the total number of red cells we have out there is very important. So the person with iron deficiency anemia has small red cells. They're very hypochromic. They're very peaky. Don't have a lot of hemoglobin in them. Hypochromic means they don't stain very well. And they're few in number. So they really are. A person really is anemic. They have problems with oxygen transport. They're short of breath. They got decreased stamina. If they've already got some coronary heart disease, if it's an older person, their angina just got a lot worse. We talked about angina, remember, a couple weeks ago. You'll be thinking more about it in a few weeks when the test comes around. But at any rate, if they've got some vascular disease now, like that, their angina's going to get worse because they don't have enough oxygen in the oxygen reserve in a red cell. So that's the situation with iron. Let's take a look here at what it looks like. Here are the red cells. I tend to use either a white cell lymphocyte or a poly as my gauge in terms of what size things ought to be, and these are actually extremely small cells. So we would see an MCV, a mean corpuscular volume, the size of the red cells would be down in the 60s, as opposed up in the high 70s or low 80s and on up. So we talked about big cells and little cells. These are little bitty guys. And they are very peaked. When you look in there, you say, wow, that's not just pallor. I mean, it's just got a tiny rim of color around the edge of it. That's all the hemoglobin that's in there, because that's all you can finish maturing because of iron deficiency. Well, the real problem then, the issue has to do with, if you're looking at ages and so forth, why are they iron deficient? Is it really, it's not in their diet? So we just send them out and say, hey, I want you to go out and eat a bunch of cheeseburgers. We'll make the Budweiser optional, but eat the cheeseburgers, you know. Well, when we're taking a look at chronic anemias, which is really the more common thing that we see, it's due to GYN blood loss from cancers, colon cancer or gastric cancer, something like that. So therein, the real problem for a person my age who has a microcytic anemia, every person in my age group, they have colon cancer. If they show up with iron deficiency anemia, they have colon cancer till you prove otherwise. Bango, the decision's already made. Bang, they got colon cancer. If somebody in your age group shows up, the odds are pretty good. It's your diet, or if you're a woman, you have heavy menstrual periods or something like that. In my case, the colon cancer is slowly bleeding over the years. It's led to my depletion of my iron stores, which you have quite a bit of normally. So iron deficiency, once again, the anemia is not the diagnosis. The anemia is the sign. Anemia is like the cough, like the fever. We don't want to just put them on iron and say, good, fine, call me in a month, you know. We don't do that. Okay, what's going to be the reticulocyte count here? Will the reticulocyte count go up or down in this situation, or stay the same? What were the reticulocytes again? The immature new cells. Yeah. They're about the same. That's exactly right. They don't change. If you saw somebody who had bad anemia, you'd expect the bone marrow would give a crap. You'd expect the kidneys would push out more erythropoietin and say, bone marrow, get to work. And they're probably doing that. It's just that, you know, there's just this limited amount of iron. They can only do so much with what they've got. That is to say, the bone marrow can. So the end result is the reticulocyte count really doesn't change much. Even in the face of high erythropoietin and the kidneys being extremely agitated by the fact that you don't have a lot of oxygen carrying capacity. So in that particular case, you'd say that should have gone up. because they're really anemic. The kidneys would have flooded them, so we either got a problem with the kidney or we got a problem with the bone marrow. We can take a look at that and see what the deal is here. So, okay. There is an interesting problem related to iron, which is not a problem of absorption or loss, called anemia of chronic disease. And this is a very real thing. Now, if you came down with an infection, if you had a pneumonia, the couple of things would change immediately that you would see. Number one, you'd know you get a fever. And you get a fever for a good reason. Most of the bugs that we get infected with are extremely tuned to our physiology, including our temperature. And they grow best at 37 degrees. Okay, run your temperature up 2 or 3 degrees and their growth almost stops. You'd think, hey, if it's hot, they ought to be growing like crazy, but it's not. They actually will slow down. So you develop a fever so that the bug growth slows down, proliferation slows down, and your inflammatory cells now have an upper hand simply because the replication rate of the bacteria is slowed down. So they got a better chance of gobbling them up and killing them. That's one thing that changes that keeps your genes in the gene pool. Another thing that happens is when you have an infection like that, all of the iron in your bloodstream is immediately put into long-term storage. Everything out there suddenly disappears. There is none available for red cell production, none available for cytochrome C production, nothing. Because these bacteria are exquisitely sensitive. They have iron-bearing enzymes very much like our cytochrome C system has. And so they need the iron to grow on, and our body has learned that. If we take that iron and put it into long-term storage, bango, right now, and drop serum iron to nothing, the bugs are going to slow down, and they do. The replication rate just comes to an almost total halt. And so your inflammatory cells, again, have the upper hand in that they can go out and gobble them up. And you could say, wait a minute, I see a problem here. If you move the iron out of the bloodstream and you don't have it available for red cell production, cytochrome C, aren't you hurting yourself? And the answer is yes, you are. But see, the trade-off is this. If I can beat that bacteria in the next 5 to 7 days, and then it's gone, and I can bring the iron back, then everything will go back to normal, and I haven't lost that many red cells. I'm not going to be anemic because of that. 5 days worth, get real, right? And that's a trade-off we make. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take all of that iron, we're going to put it into long-term storage, get away from everything, even our own cells, temporarily, to get the upper hand to kill the bacteria. If you have, now that's just a generic response. If you have an ongoing and chronic inflammatory condition, like rheumatoid arthritis, for example, if you have a truly ongoing long-term infection like tuberculosis, you put a lot of iron over a long period of time into long-term storage, and believe it or not, people will become anemic. People will develop what looks like an iron deficiency anemia. It's plenty in their diet, they're absorbing it, and immediately goes into long-term storage. And the body and the inflammatory system is saying, just hang on, we're going to beat this bug in 5 days, and then we'll bring it all back. But the red cells are basically saying, you've been saying that now for 6 months. When are you going to finally get down and beat that TB bug? When are we going to finally call a halt to this arthritis thing so you can liberate the iron and bring it back? What is essentially a normal or expected system of dealing with infections can become a problem if the inflammatory signal goes on and on and on. And in that case, we'll see people with bona fide anemias. And it looks exactly like the problem of there's no production and there isn't. And the problem is the iron that you absorb goes into long-term storage as part of that normal and expected healthy mechanism of sequestering iron so that the bacteria don't get it, even if there's no bacteria there. So it's the inflammatory signal. So there are a variety of things that can lead to this chronic inflammatory state, some of which have nothing to do with infectious agents at all. But what occurs then, what goes downstream, will be inability to produce red blood cells because of iron lack, even though the iron is sufficient. Does that make some kind of sense? Sort of? Okay. So it's actually a problem of sequestration of the iron, chronic sequestration of the iron. I mentioned hypoplasia. I'm hoping we can get done with the red cell stuff, which we might. aplastic anemias. Aplastic anemia means that the cells have died. The red cell precursors, or maybe all the bone marrow has died. So clearly, if that's the case, there are a whole lot of other much bigger problems in terms of platelet production and white blood cell production and so on. So if something kills off the bone marrow precursors, well, radiation, of course, can do it across the board. I mentioned a viral infection that we can get, a parvovirus that we get from dogs that can do it. And more than likely, almost everybody in this room has had a little parvovirus infection. You've gotten over it. That was the end of it. So occasionally, though, we will see somebody who has a parvovirus infection, typically children, and the red cell precursors have been killed off. You can imagine chemotherapy, but I just want you to see what this right here would be an aplastic bone marrow, very few precursors of anything. And here's the healthy bone marrow to compare that to. And you can see it's virtually all fat because there's practically nothing in there. Chemotherapy and radiation, of course, gets everything across the board. It's not selective for red cells. There are only a couple of situations, as I mentioned, parvovirus and that screwy tumor of the thymus gland, that for whatever reason can lead to suppression selectively of just the red cell precursor line. So when you use the term aplastic anemia, it generally means there's a whole lot more than just the anemia going on. We've also got a problem with production of inflammatory cells as well. overproduction of red cells, this happens with a variety of things. If there's overstimulus, I don't want to talk about this. You want to hear about this crap? I don't want to either. All right, we're going to pick it up here on Thursday. Thursday is I'm here at 9 o'clock, yes? You're here at 9 o'clock? Yeah, we'll pick it up there. Okay. Mm-hmm.